Russia warns it could target convoys of Western arms supplies destined for Ukraine. The Red Cross pleads the world not to forget the people of Yemen as the global attention shifts towards Ukraine. Also ahead, the United States is shutting down Afghanistan's embassy, giving diplomats 30 days to ask for humanitarian parole or face deportation. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Russian troops can target Western supplies of weapons in Ukraine. That according to the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov. He says the orchestrated pumping of weapons is a dangerous move and turns these convoys into legitimate targets. The senior Russian diplomat says Moscow has already warned Washington and its allies about the consequences of the, quote, thoughtless transfer of weapons like portable air defense and anti-tank missile systems. He is critical of the U.S. not heeding Russia's warnings. The U.S., Canada, and several European countries, including Germany, have been sending weapons to Ukraine for months. Authorities in Crimea say the United States had plans to open a biolab on the peninsula before its annexation to Russia. According to the deputy chairman of the Council of Ministers of Crimea, Washington wanted to open the lab in the capital. Georgi Mardov says that the reunification of the peninsula with Russia in 2014 stopped that plan. Muradov, who is the permanent representative of the Republic of Crimea under the Russian president, says documents discovered at that time, the former Soviet plague control station in the capital, was exposed in the plan. He also accused the Pentagon of developing biological weapons in its secret laboratories on Ukrainian territory. His comments came only a few days after Moscow accused Washington of financially supporting a military biological program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens such as plagues and anthrax. On the online video sharing platform YouTube, it says that it is blocking access globally to media funded by the Russian government. The American platform says that the decision is in line with its policy of barring content that denies, minimizes, or trivializes violent events. Earlier this month, the YouTube also blocked a lead in Russian channels RT and Sputnik across Europe amid Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the American company Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, says it is allowing posts that call for violence against Russian forces. In response, Moscow says it is restricting access to Instagram and has launched criminal proceedings against its parent company. The United Nations has also warned that the anti-Moscow move could spark hate speech against Russians. Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett explains how Western media are engaged in a propaganda campaign backed by their governments to deceive the public about what is going in the world.
Well, everything that you're watching on Russia Today and Sputnik and Press TV as well, these are the sources of truth. These are the sources of accuracy. This is the real revelation of what is going on in the ground. You can't believe anything that is coming out of the Western media. So Americans are starved for truth. That's why they have been deceived for 20 years into these endless wars, because of the propaganda that has been forced upon them from their own CIA that manipulates these big tech companies. So we're seeing big tech and the political implosion in America and this emerging deep state just suddenly start coming apart. America has now been caught with evidence of crimes against humanity, bioweapons, violation of international treaties. I'm glad to say the suggestion that we made on Press TV, the Russians have followed. They've actually went to the United Nations Security Council and are demanding investigations. And that, yet again, is another issue. The Americans are falling all over themselves, and they're doing it with absolutely no grace. The Biden administration officials are desperate to lie. This is done by people who have lost, who are in the corner, that are wounded and are about to be destroyed by the fire of their own lies. And Russia just needs to be very composed and say to the world, who do you believe, us and the facts and the evidence, or the liars who gave you 9/11 and 20 years of war against the entire world? And I think the world is going to come to the side of Iran and Russia. They just need time to see the truth.
A majority of Americans disapprove of President Joe Biden's performance, especially over his handling of the rising inflation in the country. That is according to a recent poll that was conducted by the Wall Street Journal. The poll found that 57% of respondents disapproved of Biden's performance. On the economy alone, 63% gave him negative marks. Half of the respondents said inflation is a main concern for them. Only 42% approve of the president's job. That is roughly the same percentage in a November survey. Rising costs have been a persistent issue for Biden in recent months, despite efforts to unclog supply chains. And now, the ongoing conflict in Ukraine has exacerbated U.S. inflation. That is due to rising energy and commodity prices in the wake of sanctions on Russia. The U.S. Justice Department has said that it would miss a deadline set by President Joe Biden to review and release documents from an FBI probe into the 9/11 attacks. The department was due to make public the documents by mid-March, but says more releases would occur into mid-April. Some observers believe the delay is related to the U.S. need for energy guarantees from Saudi Arabia, and that is widely accused of supporting the 2001 attacks.
September 11th, 2001. The United States is hit by four coordinated terrorist attacks, the first major assault on the U.S. soil since World War II. Nearly 3,000 people are killed and some 20,000 others injured. The U.S. responds with an all-out war on Afghanistan, where the terror group Al-Qaeda that planned and carried out the attack was said to be based. Fast forward 20 years. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order in September giving the Justice Department a six-month notice to release the documents on the FBI's investigations into the incident. Yet on Thursday, the department acknowledged that it would miss the deadline, suggesting that they would be released by mid-April. It says the delay is due to continuing coordination with a number of foreign governments and ongoing interagency review. One of the governments in question is likely to be Saudi Arabia. Out of 19 terrorists involved in the attacks, 15 were Saudi nationals. The close ties between Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Saudi royal family also raised questions that Saudi Arabian authorities supported the operation. Some observers believe the conflict in Ukraine and the West's sweeping sanctions on Russia, especially its energy sector, which has sent fuel prices skyrocketing around the world, could explain the delay in the release of the documents, as the United States needs Saudi Arabia, with the world's second largest oil reserves, to fill in the gap.
And obviously there's a quid pro quo going on here. How serious it's going to be is another question. You still got, hanging over all of this, the fact that Vice President Cheney at the time, in 9/11, arranged for all these Saudis to leave the country, leave the United States and go back to Saudi Arabia. So there was no follow-up at the time, contemporaneously, with the Saudi presence in the United States, or the fact that most of the people who were involved in the actual hijackings of these planes were Saudis. So clearly, there is something here that is extremely troubling. And clearly the Saudis do not want this out. And I suspect there are large sections of the United States government who are not interested in having a serious discussion about this.
But the delay isn't good news to thousands of families who are seeking justice for the loved ones they lost on 9/11.
Now, it is not the first time that the U.S. is acting leniently towards Saudi Arabia. Washington chose not to punish the kingdom for the 2018 murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. That comes on top of Washington's inaction on the Saudi-led war in Yemen. How much longer is the U.S. willing to get Riyadh off the hook despite mounting evidence pointing to its culpability in a slew of crimes?
Soon after taking office, Joe Biden said the U.S. was ending all its support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, proclaiming that the war has to end. But, back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States.
It's unlikely that people are going to support the United States in the hour of need without some concessions. I mean, I just don't see it. It's possible, I suppose. Maybe there's some threats or whatever, but it's unlikely. And the Saudis have been very clear in the paper today. They said they want more support by the United States for their adventure in Yemen, among other things. There was a list.
The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. But will it forgive possible perpetrators of attacks on its own citizens too? What message would that have for the attackers? Wouldn't that embolden them to commit even worse crimes, knowing that it can get away with murder in its most literal sense?
Moving on, the International Committee of the Red Cross warns that the world must not forget Yemen and other war-torn countries as the conflict in Ukraine grabs everyone's attention. The head of the Red Cross delegation in Yemen, Katharina Ritz, says that Ukraine must be added to all of the crises currently taking place, but the focus must not shift to European countries. She said that the world should not lose sight of the plight of those living through the years-long war in Yemen. Ritz added that people's duty is to equally help everyone in need. Earlier, the United Nations Children's Fund also warned that the situation in Yemen is deteriorating. It said that over 10,000 minors have so far been killed or maimed in the Saudi-led war since it began 7 years ago. 47 cases were recorded only in the first 2 months of 2022. Earlier, we talked to Melbourne-based journalist Samuel Geddes, who joined us with his take on the UN inaction on Yemen's humanitarian catastrophe caused by the Saudi-led war.
We've been constantly told how Yemen is on the edge of a famine or on the edge of a particular kind of humanitarian crisis. But of course, it has been at that stage of crisis for 7 years. From the figures that I'm aware of, the death toll is close to 400,000, and of course the vast majority of those will be civilians, and particularly civilians with particular nutritional needs, so young children, people with underlying conditions, and the elderly. And yes, I mean, nearly a decade of such acute food crisis, as well as you say, disruption to the educational system and every other system. Yes, this will, without being an expert on child health, I would definitely say that this is going to leave very long-term scars on Yemeni society and on its future social and economic development.
And the United States says Afghanistan's embassy in Washington will shut down unless a recognized government in Kabul provides enough financial support to keep the lights on. Afghan diplomats working in the U.S. have now 30 days to apply for residency or temporary humanitarian parole before they risk being deported. That is according to the State Department. The diplomats were appointed by the former U.S.-backed Afghan government. Now they could be under a threat by the ruling Taliban if they return home. The Taliban began their rule in August last year after toppling Ashraf Ghani's government and the exit of American forces from the country. Currently, an estimated 100 Afghans work at the country's embassy and consulates in the U.S. In Iran, COVID-regulated figures have been on the decline since the country faced the sixth wave of the pandemic. Over 2,200 infections were recorded on Friday. That brings the related caseload to more than 7 million. 120 people died in the same period, taking the overall death tally to 138,000. The latest wave, largely blamed on the Omicron variant, started in mid-January and caused a gradual rise in infections and deaths across Iran. Health officials managed to deal with the scenario thanks to a mass vaccination campaign. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Rights advocates have recently accused U.S. lawmakers of hypocrisy for backing severe sanctions to punish Russian aggression in Ukraine while unconditionally supporting the Zionist regime and condemning efforts to hold it accountable for violating international law in Palestine. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. Lawmakers Slammed for Double Standard on Russia and the Zionist Regime Crimes Against Palestinians. Here's the story. Rights advocates have recently accused U.S. lawmakers of hypocrisy for backing severe sanctions to punish Russian aggression in Ukraine, while unconditionally supporting the Zionist regime and condemning efforts to hold it accountable for violating international law in Palestine. Yusuf Monayer, a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C., told Politico, "We are watching at this moment a really horrific set of violations of international law and human rights in Ukraine, and we are seeing an international response that is unified, robust, and also completely hypocritical." Monayer, who supports the nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, BDS, for Palestinian rights, stressed that Russia should be held accountable for its invasion of Ukraine, while noting the disparate treatment by U.S. lawmakers of Palestinians and Ukrainians resisting aggression. Members of Congress have shown their hypocrisy on this issue by supporting anti-BDS legislation when it comes to demanding accountability for Israel's human rights violations, he said. But now they're all for these kinds of efforts targeting Russia. Before Russian troops even invaded Ukraine, lawmakers from both parties supported stringent sanctions in response to what Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Bob Menendez called Russia's brazen violation of international law for declaring Moscow-backed enclaves in Donetsk and Luhansk independent. The Zionist regime's actions constitute flagrant violations of international law, according to prominent international organizations and human rights groups. The nearly 55-year occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds, and construction and expansion of exclusively Jewish settlements on occupied Palestinian land, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinian communities, the blockade of Gaza, the killing and a wounding of civilians during military operations, ranging from wars to protest suppression, and other policies and actions, including what prominent Israeli regime and international rights groups call apartheid, all run afoul of international law. As the Biden administration, an overwhelming majority in both houses of Congress support severe sanctions targeting the Russian government and economy, they remain steadfast supporters of the fake regime of Israel, which receives $3.8 billion in unconditional annual U.S. aid and vocal opponents of efforts to boycott the nation. In 2019, House members approved a resolution condemning BDS by a vote of 398-17. Recently, Representative Lee Zeldin reintroduced the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, which in a previous iteration threatened violations with up to $1 million in fines and as many as 20 years imprisonment. On the same day, he called for an immediate end to Russian oil imports. Politico fellow Joseph Gideon noted recently that while U.S. politicians have jumped over themselves to sanction Russia back to Stone Age, widespread anti-BDS sentiment among politicians has advocates iced out of public debate. Khaled El-Gindi, A senior fellow at the Middle East Institute told Politico that the U.S. has sanctions against many countries that haven't invaded their neighbors. But whereas the international community mobilized swiftly to confront Russia's occupation of Ukraine, it has done very little to roll back Israel's occupation. It's exactly this lack of any real accountability or constraints on Israel that ultimately led to BDS movement, he added.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. We are talking about freedom and how Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam saw it important, rather he made it a policy, that people need to be free. They need to have the freedom. He himself was endeavoring his best to provide means for the welfare of people. And at the same time, he was so severe in punishing those criminals who goes against public order and public interest. And in the eyes of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi, he did not make any discrimination, nor did he try to give others rights above others. Friends and foes were equal in the eyes of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. And he himself did not have any leniency with anyone, because the truth itself is one. It is not subject to leniency. I have friends, I have cousins, I have relatives, I have, you know, tribesmen, therefore I need to be kind to them, I be not nice to them. Even with his own brother, we can see that when history tells us that his brother Aqil came to him asking for extra wealth, he denied. Not that he only denied, but he made it an example for mankind to learn from until the day of judgment, where he burned a metal rod and he puts it in the hand of his brother. When his brother, his hand got burned, he started screaming of pain and agony. And Amir al-Mu'mineen said to him, well, do you want me to burn in hell because you want me to give you the rights of other people? Now, this is the justice that we want. This is the freedom that we want. Therefore, in the eyes of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, everyone was the same, friends and foes. Ali alayhi salam was confident that his piety was well known to all, and that they were aware that he had no equal in the matter of piety. And he took from the word only as much as was sufficient for him and for his living. And this is something that we all can see when we read the life of the commander of the faithful. He did not take one extra bite more than what he had required, nor did he take an extra dime more than what he had required, or wore or bought clothes more than he had required. This fact of piety of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi was known to all. The people also knew that the only purpose of his life was to establish truth and to help the needy and the oppressed. This is another fact that no one can deny when looking at the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And that he did these things as a matter of duty, not as a matter of trying to show himself as a good character to the people, to society. Rather, was a duty of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and did not show kindness to others based on the fact that he has to compromise on these duties. On the contrary, he was firm into applying these concepts. Now, let us take a short break and we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. You are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen's concept of justice and freedom. Before he applies freedom and justice to people, he has to make it known to people that he is a worthy character, a worthy khalif, a worthy ruler to lead them and give them this right. And there was no doubt in the mind of people of his time and today that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam wasn't that. He was that and more. If you look into his life, you see that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam did not like to eat honey because he was afraid that there might be some persons and some people among his subject to whom even barely tasted the taste of honey, or even barley and bread might not be available to him. So he's, in another word, he's saying, how could I be eating honey when people don't even have barley or bread to eat? And he used to sit and wipe and sweep the treasury of the Muslims after he divided them. And then he says, I wonder if there's a hungry person out there. Now, this is what a leader should be. This is what we need as human beings. For a person to establish justice and give people freedom and give them their right in the same way Amir al-Mu'mineen did. And even in our modern day today, none have ever established such concept where they put the rights of others and the needs of others before them. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he never wore fine dresses, because there might be a member of the public who might not be having even a course of a dress to wear. And even today we have many people, when it comes to winter, for example, they haven't got winter clothes. You can see a lot of children around the world, millions of children around the world don't have clothes to wear. And we can see that this trend, even in the most civilized countries, the most secular countries, you have people below the poverty line who don't have the basic rights and they don't have the basic needs to survive. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, his conduct was different to that of the leaders and the systems that we see today and we saw throughout history. He did not like that people should call him the commander of the faithful and should not partake in their difficulties. So he's like, if you want to call me the commander of the faithful, I have to come to your help. I have to come to your need. Because before him and after him, many people have assumed this name, Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, but they were not the commanders. They were the kings and people, weren't the believers, but they were the servants. He said, if you want to give me that title, I have to live up to it. And no one lived up to that title except for him. And therefore we say it is forbidden for anyone to assume that title except for Ali alayhi as-salam. Because he only, and only he, managed to establish justice and freedom for the people. We will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
At the core of the theory of a possible criminal case against former President Donald J. Trump is the argument that he knew he had lost the election and sought to overturn it anyway. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, Panel suggests Trump knew he'd lost the election, eyeing criminal case. Shortly after the 2020 presidential election, as ballots were still being counted, the top data expert in President Donald J. Trump's re-election campaign told him bluntly that he was going to lose. In the weeks that followed, as Donald Trump continued to insist that he had won, a senior Justice Department official told him repeatedly that his claims of widespread voting fraud were meritless, ultimately warning him that they would hurt the country. Those concerns were echoed by the top White House lawyer, who told the president that he would be entering into a murder-suicide pact if he continued to pursue extreme plans to try to invalidate the results of the 2020 presidential election. Yet, Mr. Trump time and again discounted the facts, the data, and many of his own advisers as he continued to promote the lie of a stolen election. According to hundreds of pages of exhibits, interview transcripts and email correspondence assembled by the House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack for a legal filing released late on Wednesday, 9th of March. In laying out the account, the panel revealed the basis of what its investigators believe could be a criminal case against Donald Trump. At its core is the argument that, in repeatedly rejecting the truth, that he had lost the 2020 election, including the assertions of his own campaign aides, White House lawyers, two successive attorneys general, and federal investigators, Donald Trump was not just being stubborn or ignorant about his defeat, he was knowingly perpetrating a fraud on the United States. It is a bold claim that could be difficult to back up in a court of law, but in making it, the House Committee has compiled an elaborate narrative of Mr. Trump's extraordinary efforts to cling on to power. In it, Donald Trump emerges as a man unable or unwilling to listen to his own advisers, even as they explain to him that he has lost the election, and his multiple and varied claims to the contrary are not grounded in fact. At one point, Donald Trump did not seem to care whether there was any evidence to support his claims of election fraud, and questioned why he should not push for even more extreme steps, such as replacing the acting Attorney General to challenge his loss. The president said something to the effect of, "What do I have to lose? If I do this, what do I have to lose?" Richard Donahue, a former top Justice Department official, told the committee in an interview. And I said, "Mr. President, you have a great deal to lose. Is this really how you want your administration to end? You're going to hurt the country." Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, also tried to get Donald Trump to stop pursuing baseless claims of election fraud. He pushed back against a plan from a rogue Justice Department lawyer, Jeffrey Clark, who wanted to distribute official letters to multiple state legislatures, falsely alerting them that the election may have been stolen and urging them to reconsider certified election results. That letter that this guy wants to send, that letter is a murder-suicide pact, Mr. Cipollone told Donald Trump, according to Mr. Donahue. It's going to damage everyone who touches it, and we should have nothing to do with that letter. I don't ever want to see that letter again. The account is part of a court filing in a civil case in California, in which the committee's lawyers, for the first time, laid out their theory of a potential criminal case against the former president. They said they had evidence demonstrating that Donald Trump, the lawyer John Eastman, and other allies could be charged with obstructing an official proceeding of Congress, conspiracy to defraud the American people, and common law fraud. The committee's filing shows how some of Donald Trump's aides and advisers repeatedly and passionately tried to get him to back down from his various false claims and plans to try to stay in power. It started almost immediately after the polls closed in November of 2020, when members of Donald Trump's campaign data team began trying to break through to the president to impress upon him that he had been defeated. During a conversation in the Oval Office, Donald Trump's lead campaign data guru delivered to the president in pretty blunt terms that he was going to lose, Jason Miller, another top campaign aide, told the House panel. The president said he disagreed with the data expert's analysis, Mr. Miller said, because he thought he could win in courts of law. Jason Miller also told the committee that he agreed with Attorney General William Barr's analysis that there had not been widespread fraud in the election, and said that to the president on multiple occasions, the panel wrote in its court filing. In the chaotic post-election period, Donald Trump's legal team set up a hotline for fraud allegations and was flooded with unverified accounts from people across the country who claimed they had evidence of fraud. A Postal Service truck driver from Pennsylvania asserted, without evidence, that his 18-wheeler had been filled with phony ballots. Republican voters in Arizona complained that some of their ballots had not been counted because they used Sharpie pens that could not be read by voting machines. Mr. Trump appeared to be aware of many of these reports and would speak about them often with aides and officials, raising various theories about voting fraud even as they debunked them one by one. When you gave him a very direct answer on one of them, he wouldn't fight us on it, Mr. Donahue, the Justice Department official, told the House committee, but he would move on to another allegation. Mr. Donahue recalled, for instance, how he told Donald Trump that Justice Department investigators had looked into and ultimately discounted a claim that election officials in Atlanta, Georgia, had wheeled a suitcase full of phony ballots into their counting room on election day. Instead of accepting Mr. Donahue's account, Donald Trump abruptly switched subjects and asked about double voting and dead people voting, then moved on to a completely different claim about how, he said, Indians are getting paid to vote on Native American reservations. After Mr. Donahue sought to knock down those complaints as well, he told the committee, Donald Trump changed topics again and wondered aloud why his numerous legal challenges to the election had not worked. Jeffrey Rosen, another top Justice Department lawyer who became the acting Attorney General after William Barr left the agency, fielded this question, according to Mr. Donahue's account, telling the president that he was free to bring lawsuits but that the department could not be involved. Even though none of Donald Trump's persistent claims about election fraud turned out to be true, prosecutors will most likely have to grapple with the question of this, of his state of mind at the time, specifically the issue of whether he believed the claims were true, said Alan Rosenstein, a former Justice Department official who teaches at the University of Minnesota Law School. Alan Rosenstein said, to the extent that the prosecutors had to show intent, Trump's delusion makes that harder. A finder of fact could conclude that Donald Trump is so uniquely narcissistic and self-absorbed that he actually thought the election had been stolen. Throughout December, Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donahue repeatedly informed Donald Trump that both his specific and general claims of election fraud were false. At a White House meeting on 15th of December 2020, Donald Trump was told that people are telling you things that are not right, the committee said. Mr. Donahue personally informed Donald Trump during a 27th of December phone call in very clear terms that the Justice Department had done dozens of investigations, hundreds of interviews, had looked at Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Nevada, and concluded that the major allegations are not supported by evidence. The House panel also found evidence that some of the allies most deeply involved in Donald Trump's efforts to overturn his loss were aware that their endeavor lacked legal merit. Mr. Eastman, the conservative lawyer who advised Donald Trump that Vice President Mike Pence could throw out election votes from states he had lost, conceded during a conversation with Mr. Pence's top lawyer, Greg Jacob, that his arguments carried no legal weight and would fail before the Supreme Court. A rejection of electors by the vice president would be a relatively minor violation of federal law, Mr. Eastman acknowledged, agreeing with Mr. Jacobs's assessment that even the most conservative justices would reject it. If this case got to the Supreme Court, we'd lose 9-0, wouldn't we? Mr. Jacob recalled telling Mr. Eastman, according to his interview with the House committee. And he started out at 7-2. And I said, who are the two? And he said, well, I think maybe Clarence Thomas. And I said, really? Clarence Thomas? And so we went through a few Thomas opinions, and finally he acknowledged, yeah, all right, it would be 9-0. The committee recently received documents from the National Archives that showed some of Donald Trump's activities on 6th of January 2021. Among them were a morning meeting that included his eldest son's fiancée, Kimberly Guilfoyle, who has turned over 110 pages of documents to the House Committee and was issued a subpoena on Thursday. A call with former Senator Kelly Loeffler, Republican of Georgia, and a call with Mike Pence, as he tried to persuade the vice president to go along with his plans. More than 150 police officers would be injured during the mob violence that would cost several people their lives. At 4:45 p.m., with the Capitol still under attack, on 6th of January 2021, Mr. Eastman wrote to Mr. Jacob, when this is over, we should have a good bottle of wine and a nice dinner someplace. Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful narration and hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, in which the Imam mentions a lot of general etiquettes of hygiene, you know, according to Islam. The general theme of this tradition is that the Imam mentions certain etiquettes which would lead to good health, and the Imam says that if one follows these etiquettes, one would be relieved of the need of medicine ever, right? So some general good you know, etiquettes of hygiene and things that can help us remain healthy throughout our lives and free us of illness and the need for medicine. This tradition has been narrated from Imam Ali, and in it the Imam mentions these things to his son Imam Hassan alayhi salam. Imam Ali alayhi salam said the following to his son Al-Hassan alayhi salam: O son, shall I teach you four things that will make you needless of medicine? Imam Hassan alayhi salam said, Yes, O commander of the faithful. Then Imam Ali replied, Do not eat food unless you are hungry. This is the first of those general rules and etiquettes of hygiene. Do not eat unless you're hungry. If you're not hungry, you're full, don't eat. Right? If you don't feel hungry, don't eat. The second, and get up from eating while you still desire to eat more. Let's say you're hungry. You're hungry, and according to the tradition, Imam Ali says, if you're hungry, go ahead and eat. But if you're not, then don't eat. Okay, so you're hungry, you start eating. Before you become full, stop eating. Right? Don't keep eating until you become full. Stop a little bit before that. The third, chew your food well. Right? When you're eating, chew your food well before you swallow. Of course, all of these etiquettes are things which we know now are true and are beneficial based on modern medicine and nutrition. Finally, the Imam says, and before you sleep, go and relieve yourself. Right? Use the bathroom, eliminate all your bodily waste before you go to sleep. This is another good etiquette of hygiene. In the end, the Imam says, if you do these, you will be needless of medicine. Istaghnaita anittib. It's a very interesting way to end the tradition. The Imam says, if you perform these, and you continue in your performance of these things, you will never need medicine ever again. So these are some good etiquettes that we can all follow and in this way increase our health, inshallah. And coincidentally, this is also one of the etiquettes of sleeping, right? In general terms, there's a lot of etiquette. Islam has etiquettes and rules for a lot of things, for every aspect of life. This is one of those things that are a good etiquette of sleeping, some other of which have been mentioned in other traditions. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at good etiquettes of hygiene, which lead to overall good health, in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay. Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.